There we go. That does it.
Good morning, Your Honor.
That's better.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'll start again. Brandon Basie, Assistant Attorney General, on behalf of the appellant, the Commissioner of the Department of Human Services. May it please the court. The commitment appeal panel in this case, Your Honors, erred when it granted Mr. Kirchhoff's petition for provisional discharge, despite the fact that not a single witness, expert or otherwise, opined that provisional discharge was appropriate for Mr. Kirchhoff. Indeed, in the commissioner's first appeal in this case, this court acknowledged that because all of the experts opposed the requested discharge, the commissioner seems to have met his evidentiary burden.
Seems to have. But
correct,
Your Honor. That assumes that the district court accepts as credible and sufficiently weighty the expert's opinion. And on remand, the panel clarified that it was not accepting the as weighty or credible the opinions of the experts who weighed in favor of opposing the provisional discharge. How does that weigh into your analysis?
Correct, Your Honor. That is correct, and that is what the panel said below, that it was rejecting all of the the opinions of the experts, although with one of the experts, Mr. Schiffer, it never actually said that it was rejecting his opinion or provided the reasons for that. But with respect to Dr. Gierock and Dr. Obermeier, Dr. Gierock was a court-appointed examiner. Dr. Obermeier was another expert on risk. The panel's rationale for why it disregarded their opinions was merely because, as the panel saw, it was inconsistent with their testimony. However, the inconsistencies from their testimony, Your Honor, are not actually inconsistencies. It's just that the panel in this case decided to construe favorable facts for the commissioner or unfavorable facts for the appellant in a way that they saw were favorable to the appellant or to the respondent in this case. And by doing that, Your Honors, they committed error by ignoring by taking facts out of context or taking statements out of context from the witnesses and by not considering their opinions as a whole. This isn't a case where the commissioner's argument is simply that the commissioner wishes that the panel would have accepted certain facts or accepted a certain witness's testimony over another witness's testimony. This is a case where the unanimous opinions of the experts were that provisional discharge was simply not appropriate.
Because so are you asking us for a legal holding, either expressly or implicitly, asking us to hold that the panel is prohibited from disagreeing with the opinions of the unanimous body of experts?
No, Your Honor. The commissioner is not asking for a carte blanche blanket order that says in all cases where there is unanimous expert testimony that there must be a reversal.
Well, what's the rule of law then that would distinguish this from those cases that would allow a different outcome?
Your Honor, in the Addington case, which is cited by the commissioner in their briefs, the U.S. Supreme Court stated that in civil commitment cases, expert testimony is extremely important because it's not simply about what the simple facts are. This isn't a case about whether a light is green or red. It's what the facts mean. And we need expert testimony to say what the facts in the records mean. And so one could imagine a case, Your Honor, where despite there being an expert that opines that provisional discharge is appropriate, there could be a case where that expert was just simply uninformed on appropriate facts. For instance, say an expert said, I don't think that he should be provisionally discharged because he hasn't completed X in treatment, when in fact the undisputed testimony or evidence showed that he did complete X in treatment. The panel could, in a case like that, I could see a situation where a panel could say, okay, well, that expert was just simply uninformed and state that that's the reason why they're rejecting the opinion. That's not what we have in this case.
So if the expert isn't, if I understand your argument is if the experts are sufficiently informed as to what the facts mean, then a unanimous panel of experts essentially bind the review panel.
Again, Your Honor, I wouldn't say that I can't speak for every single possible scenario, but it's hard for the commissioner to imagine a case where the unanimous opinions of the expert that there's not an attack on the foundational reliability of those experts' opinions, given the U.S. Supreme Court's statement about the need for experts, and honestly, Your Honor, given the legislature's The legislature in the statute has expressly provided for the panel to appoint experts in these types of cases. You know,
Why is there a need for a review panel at all?
The panel, as far as like the...
Why would there be a need for it in the statute if you're saying that the statutory authority to appoint the panel implicitly indicates that the panel's decision, opinion on how what the facts mean is binding? Why have a panel?
Your Honor, of course that we have hearings so that we can test those opinions from the experts. The petitioner in this case is entitled to cross-examine witnesses to see what their opinions are, to provide their own experts if they so desire to retain their own experts, to attack the foundational reliability of those experts. But in the end, if those experts' opinions stand up on cross-examination, and in this case, this court observed in Kirchhoff 1 that despite the experts, that some of the experts opined that or considered that there might be some safety provisions in the provisional discharge plan, despite those things they held to their opinions. And then this court said, despite that, or in light of that, the commissioner seems to have met his evidentiary burden. And so, of course, Your Honor, that there are times where there might be something that comes up despite a expert's opinion that would undermine that or provide less credibility, but that's simply just not the case that we have in this case, Your Honor. And in fact, the respondent's brief doesn't point out to anything the respondent's brief specifically says that the panel and the experts considered the same facts, and that the experts came out to an opinion that was different than the panel's.
Counsel, what is the evidence in the record that supports the expert's opinion that there's a continued need for treatment and supervision in the current setting?
Your Honor.
Why does he need to stay at this 20-plus year mark?
So all of the experts opined that Mr. Kirchhoff continues to have struggles with his deviant arousal.
But didn't they also say that he may always have struggles with deviant arousal?
They said he may always have attractions, but that doesn't mean that those attractions cannot be managed in a successful way in order to make provisional discharge appropriate or full discharge appropriate.
Why can't they be managed in a way that allows for provisional discharge in this point?
They may well be able to eventually, but
I'm asking you is, what in the record tells us that right now the experts are right and the panel was wrong, that he needs to remain in his current treatment setting in order to manage his treatment needs?
So a couple things, Your Honor. One of the things that the experts opined, and I think it was a unanimous opinion from the experts, was that Mr. Kirchhoff is highly reliant on external factors to stay, to manage his deviant arousal.
His group, his community.
Right. It's not the therapeutic community, right? And it's not just his peers at CPS, Community Preparation Services. CPS is designed to allow for everyone, whether it's security counselors, whether it's other faculty or staff, therapists, whether it's his group, everyone around him is invested in his treatment. And what the experts opined is that he needs to work on understanding his own internal motivation and understanding how to address his deviancy in the moment on his own without other people reminding him,
simply encourage the patient to not disclose his level of arousal or what he needs for support? I mean, the argument I'm hearing says, if you let people know what's going on and that you're relying on them for help, you're never going to get out. So the way to get out of here is to just not disclose any of this, not rely on your peers, not rely on the supports that are there.
No, Your Honor, that's not the commissioner's argument. The commissioner's argument...
I know it's not your argument, but it's my concern.
And I don't think the court should be concerned with that, Your Honor, because there can be evidence. One can discuss their use or their reliance on peers, but there's also evidence of, for instance, if you're in the community and there's certain ways to manage deviant arousal, what they're looking for is people to be able to take care of those things on their own. And
what in the record evidence shows us that he's not doing that?
So there were instances of him being in the community where he forgot to bring his aversive methods. There was also evidence when he was, that there's been instances of peers telling him that he shouldn't be watching certain TV shows because it might spur his deviancy. There's evidence in the record talking about how his peers have identified further times where he should use his aversive ammonia in order to do that. There's another thing that the experts opined to in this case, Your Honor, was that he has history of stuffing emotions, and when he stuffs emotions, that has led to his deviant thinking and deviancy in the past. And there's been instances where he has not been able to kind of discuss those things internally. He keeps them inside without discussing them, and that's led to him blowing up on treatment providers and things like that, such as calling them a Nazi and referring treatment to gas chambers. So there are instances in there in the evidence that support the.
So if the evidence shows that, what does the evidence show about whether conditions of a provisional discharge will provide a reasonable degree of protection to the public? Because it seems to me, okay, he still has some issues on treatment, then that has to be balanced with, well, can we manage those issues with appropriate safeguards so there's no threat of harm to the public?
You're right.
So what does the evidence show on the second part of that equation?
Your Honor, and I would just like to be clear, it's not just protect the public, but it's protect the public and provide an adequate ability to adjust successfully to the community. And so the experts all opined that they were familiar with outpatient treatment places, they were familiar with outpatient residences, and none of those residences could provide the same type of therapeutic community that CPS provides.
Okay, well, let me stop you there. So then are you basically conceding that the placement he would receive would be adequate to protect the public in terms of house arrest, GPS, monitoring, all of those things, and the concern is, yes, but they're not going to allow him to successfully adjust to the community?
Your Honor, I think one.
My question then becomes, how does he successfully adjust to the community in CPS? It seems like he has to take the next step to adjust to the community.
CPS provides a number of reintegration opportunities. CPS's whole goal is reintegration. And so CPS will provide him continued opportunities to go into the community, to test the things that he's learning, to work on those motivations that he has, and to work on those in a gradual way. Dr. Obermeyer in this case stated that that's what he needs to do, is go through the CPS program and have more experiences in the community and work on those things. Your Honor, I think one could imagine, one could put a provisional discharge plan in a case that has, 50-foot walls and surrounded by, barbed wire and things like that. You can imagine scenarios where you could put a provisional discharge plan in that provides high security. But the point of provisional discharge is to reduce the level of supervision of an individual and help them adjust to the community.
How old is Mr. Kirchhoff?
I don't remember his exact age, Your Honor. I believe he's old. He's older.
How many years has he been in confinement as the under the civil commitment restrictions? Let me ask an easier question. At what age do the experts suggest people be ready, more prepared for provisional discharge?
Your Honor, I don't think age is a specific factor in this.
Thought I saw a mention in the record that at age 60, he would be more inclined, or the experts would be more inclined to approve his provisional discharge request.
Your Honor, with respect, that wasn't the testimony, Your Honor. I think that the argument is that at age 60, one of his actuarial scores on the static 99R would, one of the metrics is the individual's age. So when he reaches age 60, his score might decrease. But none of the experts stated that when he reaches age 60, that his score will all of a sudden be at a point where he should be provisionally discharged. That isn't part of the record.
No, I know the opposite, though, was in the record, though, wasn't it? That not until age 60 did the experts expect that he would, that age would be a factor that works to his favor.
Your Honor, I don't believe that that was what was in the record, Your Honor. I believe that they said that his, based on his, so that's just one of the actuarial scores. That's the static, which is talks about static risk factors, which aren't amenable to treatment. He also has a number of dynamic risk factors, which are risk factors that are amenable to treatment that they believe he needs to work on.
The district court rejected a couple of the experts on the basis that their opinions were not supported by the facts. And as to Dr. Garrock, that his opinion was too equivocal to meet the clear and convincing standard. The burden, of course, is on the state to establish that. Isn't it the panel's responsibility to interpret the facts?
It's the panel's responsibility, Your Honor, to determine whether the experts opinions are supported by the facts.
Right, but ultimately that requires an interpretation of the facts to in order to assess whether they're properly aligned.
Correct, Your Honor, but there wasn't a disagreement in the facts. And I think that the respondent acknowledges.
But there's a disagreement about the interpretation of the facts, isn't it? I mean, that's what led to the panel's disagreement with the experts.
Correct, Your Honor, and as the Supreme Court stated in the Addington case, that the courts should be highly, they need experts to interpret what the facts mean, because the court aren't psychologists. They're not individuals who are trained in examining risk and examining someone's need for treatment. And so we need experts in these cases in order to provide the court with that type of information.
So I'm clear, if I can ask one more question, as your time is up. You're essentially asking for a pretty deferential approach to the experts' opinions, I think.
Your Honor, I don't think it's the commissioner asking for that. I think it's what the Supreme Court has stated is just an inherent part of civil commitment cases, is that these cases are highly, these aren't cases about.
Was there a case that you found where that language was used, or what is the case that most supports the implicit proposition that you're saying is required to be applied by the panel, that there must be this deference to the opinions of the experts?
Your Honor, I mean, we would rely on the Addington case that we've cited.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jennifer Tone. I'm the attorney for the respondent, Jerry Kirchhoff, in this matter. I want to start by touching on an issue that we discussed a couple weeks ago in a different appeal panel case that was before this court. When we're looking at these cases, and I think particularly given the facts of this case, what the appropriate standard of review is a critical issue. I did some research after we were here a few weeks ago about standards of review, and you know, in the last argument and in the case law, the language is somewhat ambiguous. The courts routinely state that a clear error is the appropriate standard of review, but then a lot of the decisions that I looked at also contain that language we discussed last time, where it says that this court applies a de novo standard of review to issues of statutory interpretation and to a judicial appeal panel's application of the law to the facts of a particular case. And when I went back and looked at those cases, I did not really find that any court was doing a de novo review of the judicial appeal panel cases when it gets to the merits of the petition at the end of a Part 2 hearing. So I think when we're considering the fact that the two expert opinions in this case and the other fact witnesses did not necessarily support Mr. Kirchhoff's petition for a reduction in custody, I don't think that this court needs to give a de novo review. And I think that based on the Crop case, you know, we're not reweighing the evidence in this case. And when you look at the entirety of the record, the panel's decision is supported by the facts in the evidence.
What evidence supports the panel's decision over the objection of the experts?
So I think when you're looking at the treatment perspective, you look at the treatment, all the statements that the witness has made about how well Mr. Kirchhoff has done. He's made significant progress in treatment. When you look at his treatment ratings, you know, when his actual providers are scoring him, he's doing satisfactory and higher work. When you look at his remaining treatment needs, the testimony from the two experts that testified in this case, outpatient programs treat the same types of issues. They use the same kinds of tools and therapies and treatments that his current setting uses. And when it comes to that DVNC issue in particular, that arousal management program that's offered by MSOP, to the extent that that's somewhat unique, Mr. Kirchhoff can continue to attend that programming even if he is provisionally discharged. We also had testimony in the record from Dr. Gearock that when you're looking at the number of treatment hours, some outpatient programs have less treatment hours. Some outpatient programs have more treatment hours. We have testimony from Mr. Schiffer that says MSOP is committed to provide the appropriate level of treatment for clients as long as they're under the MSOP realm. Provisional discharge is still part of the MSOP program because it's a program, not a location. And so whether if Mr. Kirchhoff has a need for more treatment hours, MSOP is committed to meet that need even if he is provisionally discharged. So from a treatment perspective, his treatment needs can be adequately met within a community setting.
And do we know where he would go if he is provisionally discharged? I see that initially he recommended his mother's home, and that did not seem to be an appropriate location because of lack of services and supervision. What would the plan be? Or is the location undetermined until we find an appropriate place?
Correct, the second option. Location for both residence and treatment is undetermined. Scott Halverson, he is the director of the reintegration. He manages clients, the program that he manages the agents who supervise clients in the community on provisional discharge. He specifically testified that MSOP DHS has a policy and a plan in place, so if and when a panel grants a client provisional discharge, MSOP will assess the client and determine appropriate residence and treatment locations. So that has not yet been identified, but there's a plan in place from MSOP to find appropriate housing and treatment once discharged.
How does a person go from provisional to full discharge?
How, as in, what do they need to accomplish?
Exactly. I mean, is there a definitive timeline, or is it you're much like every other stage of this program until enough people say you're ready to move on?
I think it's the latter. It's whenever everybody agrees you're ready to move on. I mean, that's one of my fundamental frustrations with this program is there is never a timeline, and it's always a never-ending moving target at the end of this. There is not clear understanding what it takes for a client to necessarily get to the next step. You know, the benefit of provisional discharge is that once you get into the community, MSOP DHS has that gradual reintegration process. They have that policy with the supervision. It's much like intensive supervised release from the Department of Corrections. So they start out at a much more restrictive setting where their liberties and their privileges are pretty monitored. They're not allowed to go places unescorted. As they do well, without having to go to a special review board, a judicial appeal panel, any other body, the reintegration team, the treatment providers, can increase those liberties. So the longer in the community they are, they have opportunities to demonstrate that they're adopting well, adjusting well to the community. The program itself can grant them more liberties so that we can have that gradual stepwise production to see how they're doing. And as they, you know, work through those tiers of supervision, I imagine the intention of the policy is by the time they get towards the end of that tiered system, the program would be looking at supporting for a full discharge.
I asked Mr. Basie whether he was essentially asking us to completely defer to the panel's determination. I'll ask you a similar question. Are you asking us essentially to our court to defer necessarily to the panel's determination? I mean, you have a 45-year-old man who has a history of sexually abusing children. There's 41 victims in his wake, ranging in age from several months to 15 years. And a unanimous panel of experts says he's not ready for provisional discharge. So I'm curious whether the heart of your argument is we're stuck with the panel's decision on review. If it's not a de novo review, we're essentially rubber stamping what the panel says, even if it's in the face of all of the experts.
I would say this, that fundamentally this is a legal determination. It is not a psychological determination. And it is not something that is exclusively in the providence of psychologists and experts. The psychologists are there to translate psychological facts or knowledge into legal word. The psychologists assist the court in qualifying that evidence into the legal standards, but ultimately it's the court's fundamental responsibility and them alone that gets to make the decision. And I think, you know, Mr. Basie gave some examples. In the case where there is a clear error, I think that makes sense, and it gives this court the protective safeguard where you're not automatically reliant on the panel. You don't have to rubber stamp anything. If there are instances of clear error and all of the evidence flies in face.
But what would a clear error look like here if this isn't the case? All the experts say Ms. Kirchhoff's not ready for a provisional discharge into the community. And the panel says, we think that opinion is too equivocal to rely upon, and so we disagree, and he's released.
I think in this case, part of my issue, part of my argument is that the two expert witnesses didn't have full knowledge of all the relevant issues. You know, and those tiers of supervision that I talked about that are put, that provisional discharge clients are subjected to, Dr. Obermeyer, for example, is the very clear example. So she is an MSOP DHS forensic evaluator. This is a DHS for MSOP policy. She had no knowledge of what that looks like. So when you as an expert are saying that there is no gradual supervision or reduction of custody on provisional discharge, and you are completely unaware of what this policy is and what that actually looked like, I think that's a fundamental flaw in your opinion. And that was the case in this particular case for Mr. Kirchhoff. Dr. Gierek, on the other hand, testified that he was vaguely familiar or minimally familiar with that policy. And both of those two doctors, that was one of the critical factors for them. Gradual reduction in custody, gradual steps with more freedom, less supervision is necessary and important for that successful adjustment. Neither one of them really knew what that looked like. And if you only know what half the story is, how are you making a well-educated, informed opinion that you're giving to the panel? The panel had all of that evidence in front of it.
The panel also had the provisional discharge plan.
Correct.
Including, you mentioned a gradual reduction, but it looks like, when I look at the plan, there's, after 30 days, the intense supervision seems to, it's no longer required by the plan.
My recollection of the testimony from Mr. Halverson, the reintegration director, is that the tiers of supervision within that policy, it states how long a client is supposed to remain in each tier. But fundamentally, it's up to the reintegration agent and the treatment providers to decide. So just because that 30 days is up doesn't mean the client is automatically progressed to the next tier and they're getting given that reduction in custody. They're allowed to remain in those tiers for longer than any given time. So that is solely at the discretion of the MSOP reintegration agents. Another big part of the argument was that when you look at the terms of that provisional discharge plan and you look at what things Mr. Kirchhoff is doing and is expected to be doing at community preparations currently, there's a lot of overlap. It really isn't that different. And it actually, you know, the daily schedule was one clear example that pops to mind here initially. Mr. Schiffer testified that when clients reside at community preparation services, they're pretty independent in their schedule. Their treatment schedule is basically set by providers, but their day-to-day activity is getting to work on time, what they do with recreation, those types of things. They're free to manage that as they see fit and appropriate. Obviously, they're given guidance about, you know, what would be in their best interest, but ultimately, they're independent in setting that daily schedule. When you compare that with a provisional discharge, for example, clients on provisional discharge have to plan a weekly schedule, have it approved ahead of time with the reintegration agent. So a lot of the things that he's already doing are the same things that are required under provisional discharge. And, you know, like I said, the benefit of that provisional discharge plan is once you get out, you're locked down, so to speak, initially, where there's close supervision, not a lot of movement. That's when the high stress period of time is that the examiners talked about. Once Mr. Kirchhoff gets through that point in time and he's demonstrated that he's making that adjustment, he's doing well, there aren't safety concerns, he's doing what is asked and required of him, then through the MSOP reintegration team, those restrictions can be lessened so that he can take that next step and really start adjusting into the community, getting more liberty, having additional opportunities where he can prove that he is ready to make that adjustment to society and then ultimately prove that he will be ready for full discharge down the road. One thing that I just wanted to touch on very briefly, community preparation services is a transition program. They have these stages that clients are subjected to. Mr. Kirchhoff is in stage two of the four stages. Prior to that stage program being implemented, he was granted a number of community outings. He had testified that he had hundreds of community outings and without issue prior to the implementation of that privileges system out at CPS. Neither of the two experts in this case either were aware of that. You know, I think that when you're a client that's out at CPS, you can only do so many things to demonstrate that you're ready to take that next step. He had these outings. He was successful. There was some kind of issue, as Mr. Basie mentioned, where he didn't bring his ammonia on one occasion. That was testified about and explained and analyzed by Dr. Gearock at the Phase 1 SCAP hearing. When we got to the Phase 2 SCAP hearing, Dr. Gearock again talked about that issue. Mr. Kirchhoff had addressed that issue in his group, and he made the phrase or the statement that he now carries his ammonia around like it's his wallet. So, you know, even within that limited context, when he has limited opportunities to prove or demonstrate himself, he still was able to make those demonstrations that further support the panel's decision. So this isn't a case where the panel completely said, you know, the experts are off their rockers. In this case specifically, the panel said, I agree with many of the same things that you tell me are relevant facts. We're just extrapolating different conclusions. And these are legal conclusions, not psychological conclusions. I think that concludes my remarks, unless the court has additional questions.
No questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. Respondent cites a number of things in their argument about potential reasons why the panel may or may not have discredited these experts. The issue with that argument is that none of those reasons that the respondent cited today were actually stated by the panel in its order. The panel simply said that the facts that they related did not support their opinion, but when you look at the facts that they related in their order, they just simply disregarded, in some cases, sentences completely adjacent to the ones that they quote in the sentence.
Do you disagree that two of the experts did not know about the gradual reduction system that would be in place in a transitional discharge?
I do, Your Honor. I do disagree. I will agree that the experts stated that they weren't aware of the specific, what each tier encapsulated and what this very specifics. But what Dr. Obermeyer testified to in her testimony, she stated that she knew about reintegration agents. She stated that she knows that they work closely with those who are provisionally discharged. She stated that she knows that they interact with them and work to taper off their supervision with them. And she knew that their goal was to help them adjust to the community. So to say that they didn't have any idea about what the reintegration is just simply not true. But I would agree that they didn't know the exact tier particulars.
What about counsel's argument that the experts did not know that under a previous planned structure in CPS, Mr. Kirchhoff had been allowed hundreds of community outings with no incidents?
I would also disagree with that characterization of the evidence, Your Honor. What the experts opined to in this case was that they didn't remember the exact number, but they were aware that he had a history of going out in the community and kind of what those entailed, but they could not remember exactly how many that he went on. But I would disagree that they didn't know about it generally. Your Honor, one thing I was struck with that the respondents stated in their argument is that provisional discharge will allow Mr. Kirchhoff to prove that he's ready to adjust to society. And if provisional discharge, if their argument that he needs that to prove he's capable of adjusting, that's not the standard, then he's not ready for provisional discharge, because the standard is that someone is provisionally discharged when they are capable of adjusting to the society.
I thought the argument was that he'll never be able to demonstrate the capacity that he argues he has, and that the panel apparently found that he has, which is to be safe to society during a provisional discharge. I thought that was the gist of the argument.
Well,
maybe
I
misunderstood it.
That could be, but that's also, if that is, that's simply just not also true, because he has opportunities, as the testimony stated in this case. Once he continues to progress at CPS, he'll have more opportunities to go in the community. He'll have opportunities to do different support groups in the community as he progresses and furthers along his treatment at CPS. These are all available. That's the point of CPS, is to help them integrate in the community.
It also sounds like much of what's available at CPS would be available in a transitional discharge, in terms of supervision where he resides, treatment where he resides, still participating in certain programs at CPS like aversion therapy. I mean, I'm having a hard time conceptualizing the difference between the two, because it sounds like there's a lot of overlap. What's the biggest get for him if he goes to transitional discharge?
I think, Your Honor, that he will have more opportunities to go into the, like, he'll be, they'll have less supervision. He'll be able to go into the community more, and he won't have the same type of restrictions. You heard counsel talk a lot about.
The provisional discharge plan says first 30 days at a minimum, he can't leave his residence unless he's accompanied, and that's at a minimum. It seems like even the provisional discharge plan would be quite supervised and, you know, ultimately in the discretion of the MSOP program.
Your Honor, I think that one could write a provisional discharge plan to be extremely restrictive. And I think the commissioner's point is if we're going to have provisional discharge plans that are essentially the same thing as what he has at CPS, that's not provisional discharge. That's not adjusting to the community. That's not reducing custody. It's going to a different place with the same custody, and that's not the point of provisional discharge. The last thing I'd like to say, Your Honor.
Chris, whatever you're going to say last, I'd like you to also touch on something that you didn't emphasize in your primary argument in chief, which is the standard, the burden on the state, and the standard, that the burden on the state is clear and convincing evidence, and as opposed to just preponderance of the evidence.
Thank you, Your Honor, and that's exactly where I was going with my last point. Your Honor, the commissioner does acknowledge it's clear and convincing evidence, but clear and convincing evidence is not beyond a reasonable doubt. Clear and convincing evidence is highly probable or highly likely. In this case, the commissioner presented three unanimous opinions of experts that said the provisional discharge wasn't appropriate. And if this isn't sufficient to meet the commissioner's burden of clear and convincing evidence, it's unclear of what additional evidence the commissioner would have to put in a case in order to meet that burden. The standard of review must be de novo as far as application of law to fact, or else the concern that this court expressed in respondent's argument that this court would be a rubber stamp to panel decisions would be the case. And I know that I'm out of time, Your Honor, but there are a number of cases that do apply de novo standard of review to application of fact to law in civil commitment cases, one, as well as other cases such as criminal cases. And
thank you. Thank you both for your arguments in this case. Matter is submitted, and you'll have our decision in the time required.